what the changes will lead to.
Lecture 30, The World Economy, Change and Continuity.
We're talking in this session about the world economy in the contemporary period of world history, 20th, early 21st centuries. This is a fascinating opportunity to note continuity in world history between long 19th century or even early modern / long 19th century and contemporary, but ultimately also to talk about change. And the discussion today needs to be put in the context of the kind of periodization of the contemporary era that we talked about in the previous session. At first blush, one might argue this is one area where continuity predominates. After all, you can concede independence of new nations, you can concede changes in the situation of women, but surely in the world economy, there's more persistence than change. The core, as we've discussed it in previous sessions, undoubtedly still exists, and therefore peripheries still exist. That's continuity, although we have to note some important adjustments. We use a term, the third world, that in some ways would seem to enshrine continuity. The first, second, third world ideas were initially Cold War terms, but over time, third world came to mean parts of the world that were not industrialized, that were vastly poorer than the first world, higher rates of infant mortality, lower educational levels, lower life expectancy, a whole series of indices by which we measured great gaps between the industrialized part of the world and the bulk of the world, gaps that obviously had begun to open up in the long 19th century in many ways. And the world economy concept itself, as enunciated by Emanuel Wallerstein, was meant to enshrine persistence. Wallerstein's whole point, he's a sociologist, not an historian, Wallerstein's whole point was that you needed to go back to the early modern period and then the 19th century to see the origins of the fatal economic gaps that would persist in the contemporary world. That's why he was interested. And again, he was partly right. The core. Core characteristics can still be identified in the 21st century. There are societies in the world, and they include old core participants, Western Europe, much of Western Europe at least, and the United States, which had joined the core so solidly by 1900. Core societies continued to operate, and in broad outlines, in ways that were quite similar to their previous patterns. They exported expensive goods. They imported cheaper goods. They relied on wage labor. They had, for the most part, strong and often fairly stable governments, the basic definitions that we saw applicable even in the 16th century. Again, the goods changed. The core now exported financial services, professional services of various sorts, including banking and other kinds of consultations. They included, interestingly, a whole host of entertainment staples. The second largest export of the United States by the 1990s involved movies, videos, music, etc. And by the early 21st century, Japan's leading export involved recreational activities of this sort, animated cartoons, movies, music, games, of course, etc. So the list here had changed. But again, one was talking about relatively sophisticated products through which one could make a good bit of money. The trading companies that dominated the export of these goods still emanated from the core. Ships now might carry the flags of other countries for convenience purposes, but the basic definition still applied. There were a couple of anomalies that had probably begun to develop in the 19th century that need to be noted. A few societies, mostly where white settlers predominated, didn't actually display core characteristics in terms of export-import, but managed still to maintain a fairly high standard of living. Notably, places like Canada and Australia. Canada, a leading raw materials and food supplier to the United States. Australia, by the later 20th century, the leading raw materials supplier to Japan. produced a lot of goods that were technically unprocessed, though they had significant industrial sectors as well. But because they produced these goods with relatively sophisticated technology and paid relatively high wages, they sort of fit a semi-core definition in ways that don't need to delay us too much. Peripheries obviously still existed because core can't exist without periphery. Peripheries still characterized by relatively weak governments, perhaps a bit stronger than before, but relatively weak on a global scale. Peripheries continued to export cheap goods. These goods might now include lower-level kinds of factory production, where low labor costs predominated. That is, textile goods, certain kinds of electronic equipment, this sort of thing. So again, the roster changes, but the basic definition, and particularly the fundamental inferiority in global economic exchange, continued to be significant. The location of the periphery obviously shifted. There were still peripheral societies in parts of Latin America, parts, though not all, of Central America, and parts of the Andean region in Latin America. The exports of these parts of Latin America sometimes now included some new goods, not only some cheap factory products in certain instances, for example, from Nicaragua, but also goods such as drugs that many observers have argued are in some ways a classic peripheral good in which a few people can make a good bit of money. Most of the actual peasant producers of the good earn very little, and the good enters the world economic exchange in order to be exchanged with the core. An odd anomaly, but one that actually might fit rather interestingly into the world economic framework. The key periphery now, however, during the contemporary period of world history, became many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where food supplies, raw materials, mining supplies became predominant. Although Africa had been colonized by the end of the long 19th century, it's really only in the 20th century that the African economy becomes converted more fully to peripheral status, with the colonial powers expanding mining operations, converting many areas to the production of goods like cotton. The Portuguese in their colonies in Africa, for example, greatly expanded cotton production at the expense of soil quality and local food production as well. The peripheralization of Africa was really a significant development in the contemporary period and marks one of the features we most obviously note and frequently lament about the state of much of Africa today. So, location shifts, but again, many aspects of the fundamental definition prevail. Probably the most striking shift, if we just stopped there, that one would have to note during the contemporary period of world history was the significant entry to the core, first of Japan and then of other parts of the Pacific Rim, headed, of course, by South Korea and Taiwan. The advent of Japan and the Pacific Rim, Japan, of course, had begun industrializing at the end of the 19th century, emerged into core status only after the 1950s, when it rapidly became the second largest economy in the world after the United States. The emergence of these societies into the core was a truly significant world historical development in two senses. Obviously, first, most basically, it now significantly modified the easy association of core with West. So when we talk about the relative decline of the West in world affairs, we now can add that the core is essential monopoly over Western Europe's essential monopoly over core status is now qualified significantly by the addition of parts of East Asia. The more subtle change that this development involves is obviously the recognition that a second culture zone becomes capable of advanced industrialization and participation in the core. Japan, South Korea, Taiwan imitated Western countries in many respects. They imported technologies. They took advantage of Western economic assistance in some instances or military purchases in the case, for example, of South Korea. But they did not operate from a fundamentally Western cultural base, but rather from a modified Confucianism, and it became clear that Confucianism was a second cultural tradition that could be adjusted in ways that were successful in world economic competition. Confucian emphasis on group loyalty, on group values, on collective decision-making and obedience to decisions once made, on close relationships between the state and what we would call the private sector. These attributes were obviously different from those of the West, but as it turns out, equally successful to the point that for a time in the 1980s, Westerners were wondering if their economies didn't need to shift toward a more Neo-Confucian basis. This obviously, again, represented an important set of changes. So, one could look at key developments in the contemporary period of world history and argue the world economy is still flourishing, for better or for worse. There are still societies that reap disproportionate benefits from world economic trade. There are still societies that labor under terribly difficult inferiorities. The pattern is basically persistent. All that's changed is some geography, some of the entrants in both camps, and some of the specific goods exchanged. And these would be important observations that obviously, among other things, call attention to the persistence and sometimes the worsening of global economic inequalities and the other gaps that accompany this in terms of life expectancy levels, educational levels, and so on. But emphasis on persistence would, I think, miss the more important development, which was the clear beginnings, at least, of efforts to move away from the world economic framework in one of several ways, or maybe more than one, because efforts were frequently conjoined. The world economic framework, in this sense, is still a very useful analytical tool for contemporary world history, but in terms of adjustment and reaction, not of literal continuity. Several things happened. Perhaps first, beginning fairly early in the 20th century, a number of societies decided that the world economy was not working to their benefit and they needed to use political devices to pull out, to set up their own market framework, their own exchange framework that would release them from primary dependence on global economic relationships. The first big country to do this was, of course, Russia under communism, particularly under Stalinism, where the doctrine of socialism in one country essentially proclaimed that the Soviet Union could carry through an industrialization process without significant contact with the rest of the world. They would not sell a lot to the rest of the world. They would not buy a lot from the rest of the world. They would not depend on outside experts, save to a very limited degree. And at least for several decades, it looked like this policy, which was really, really a revival of an attempt to be external, it looked like this policy worked. The Soviet process of industrialization accelerated rapidly at many points. For example, during the 1950s, Soviet economic growth seemed to be more rapid than that of places like the United States. We know now that all of this came at considerable cost in terms of low wages, social frustration, and environmental damage. But at the time, it looked like a very successful policy, and it certainly, certainly freed this country, the Soviet Union, from world economic relations of the Wallersteinian sort. China, later, under Chairman Mao, particularly in the 1960s period, attempted a similar isolation. Initially, China's industrialization after the Communist Revolution was completed in 1949. China's industrialization was meant to proceed along somewhat Soviet lines and in conjunction with the Soviet Union, but then China moved toward even a more go-it-alone policy with the notion that it could utilize its vast population base, create industrial centers in individual households, and bypass some of the conventional apparatus of industrialization, and it could do this largely independently of the rest of the world, including now the somewhat hostile Soviet Union. A fascinating experiment over several decades in relative economic isolation. Japanese efforts, as World War II neared, to set up a set of Japanese relationships with a colonial sphere in East and Southeast Asia represented another effort at partial economic isolation. Japan envisaged what it called the co-prosperity sphere, in which a set of countries would trade with Japan in unequal relationships. It was sort of a world economy in miniature, but in substantial isolation from larger world currents. Nazi Germany obviously also to some extent sought to separate itself from the world economy. The basic hope was, if hope is the right word, was that Germany could set up a colonial relationship with the agricultural regions of Eastern Europe and, again, have a mini-world economy in which German industrial might was supported by cheap exports from the Slavic hinterland and, again, would isolate itself from world economic currents. This was a fascinating interlude, and it is obviously echoed even in the 21st century by small cases of economic isolation. North Korea comes to mind most notably. But it's equally noteworthy and a really significant set of developments in world history that by the later 20th century, most of the societies that had tried the go-it-alone policy came to the conclusion that this policy was a mistake, that it cost too much in terms of isolation from the most advanced technologies, the most promising opportunities for world trade, and one by one, the world economy was rejoined. Japan obviously rejoined the world economy, as did Germany, as a result of defeat in war. China decided to re-enter the world economy soon after the death of Chairman Mao. The decision was made in 1978 as China opened its markets to greater world trade and more outside expertise. And the Soviet Union under Gorbachev in 1985 decided the same thing, that isolation was too great a price to pay for the preservation of some economic independence. So a fascinating chapter, a fascinating set of experiments in modifying the pressure of the world economy seems to have come to an end, although obviously it could recur. The more durable efforts to adjust to the world economy in ways that would complicate the fairly pure core-periphery relationship, the more fascinating and durable efforts fall into several categories. But before detailing these, we need to be reminded that we explored in discussing the early modern period, and certainly in the long 19th century, how terribly difficult it is to climb out of the periphery. When you have a low-wage economy, a small capitalist class, intense pressure for more sophisticated exports and more powerful countries from the core, it's very difficult to climb out, and it's not surprising that relatively few societies, even in the early 21st century, have climbed out completely. And elements of peripheralization in the sense of low-wage export sectors, elements of peripheralization will still exist in the economies we're about to discuss. But one of three methods, often again in combination, could begin to get countries out of the worst throes of peripheralization. The first method, it's very humble, not very dramatic. The first method began to take shape, interestingly, in the 1920s with a policy called import substitution. And early countries to introduce this policy included places like Turkey and Iran, newly independent after World War I, where import substitution was practiced relatively self-consciously. The technique is this. You use the government, working hopefully with some interested private entrepreneurs, you use the government to help set up production branches of some of the essential but less sophisticated types of industrial products so that you no longer have to import them from the core. Products such as textiles, automobiles, basic appliances, that sort of thing. By doing this, obviously, you don't necessarily totally break the core-periphery relationship, but you reduce it because you reduce the number of items, the number of relatively expensive foreign currency-requiring items that you're bringing in from the outside. Import substitution is, of course, accompanied usually by protective tariffs, and many economists, particularly in these days of free market thinking, many economists question the long-term utility of these measures. But short run, these measures actually can work in helping to create a bit of a window through which the worst kinds of dependency can be modified. Latin American countries, suffering hugely from the Great Depression, which hit their resource sales tremendously, Latin American countries began to move toward import substitution in the mid to late 1930s, headed by places like Mexico, Brazil, etc. India would adopt measures of import substitution after it achieved independence in 1947. The goods that were produced for import substitution were not necessarily as high quality as those produced by the core. Locally produced automobiles, for example, were frequently derided as being inadequate, etc. And many people, particularly the wealthy, resented the fact that to get a really good product, you had to pay these huge import duties. But the fact was, these products did satisfy part of local demand. They did reduce the pressure, the trap between expensive exports, cheap imports. So that was step number one. And many parts of the world followed this policy, and some continue to follow it to this day, though it's now less popular. Option number two was not available to all comers, but option number two involved the capacity to seize on one particular kind of good that was either so valuable or that could be newly produced so efficiently that this good, translated into exports, would begin to break out of the peripheral economic mold. The most obvious case in point here, familiar to everybody, was, of course, Middle Eastern oil. Middle Eastern oil, increasingly sought from the early 20th century onward, was initially a peripheral product. When Western companies controlled the oil supply, controlled the wells in the Middle East and North Africa, oil was essentially a cheap product that mainly fed the profit coffers of the Western corporations. But once political independence was achieved by major Middle Eastern and North African nations after World War II, political measures could be utilized to seize control of the oil and to make it a very profitable export indeed. And obviously, that's what's happened to key countries like the Gulf states, Iran, Iraq, some parts of North Africa in the decades since the 1950s. These countries might not yet round out into fully modern or industrial economies, though many of them are attempting to use oil resources to produce longer-term economic diversification. But the development certainly helped ease the core periphery pressure from a number of the wealthier segments of this part of the world. But other products could be utilized as well. Chile, for example, by the 1970s and 80s, was breaking out of the worst peripheral trap by emphasizing vegetable and fruit production for particularly United States markets. This was obviously not a highly processed good, but by using more modern technologies, by improving without revolutionizing conditions of labor, Chile began to managed to emphasize this export sector in a way that was consistent with greater economic prosperity, with greater parity in terms of world exchange. So along with import substitution, many countries obviously managed to seize on particular opportunities or methods to break out of peripheral status to some degree. Method number three, develop at least a few sectors in which your economy could begin to compete with the big boys and actually export widely in the processed goods market on a worldwide basis. There are a lot of examples here. Brazil, for example, negotiated with the United States during World War II the American provision of a modern steel industry in return for American use of some Brazilian observation posts during the war. The Brazilians knew exactly what they wanted to do, and they utilized this initially imported technology to build a steel industry that by the 1970s and 80s was capable of competing successfully with steel producers in many parts of the world, including the United States. Brazilian steel was one of the core types of commodities, even though Brazil as a whole economy was not yet core. Brazil provides a second example. the Brazilians became aware of the military implications of the computer industry fairly early, and the government began to sponsor military investments in computers. And from this base, which initially involved some technological exchange with other parts of the world, including the United States, from this base, Brazil began to develop one of the leading computer export activities in the world as a whole. Most Brazilian computers are exported not to first world markets, but to markets of other less developed countries where they're capable, for example, of withstanding interruptions in electricity supply. But the Brazilian computer export industry became fourth largest in the world. Again, Brazil's competing in this sector with core societies. The Brazilian economy continues to have large patches of poverty. Many industries and agricultural sectors that smack still of peripheralization, but because of leading export sectors plus some import substitution, Brazil moves out of the easily definable category. Mexico, Turkey, there are many other examples of these gradual processes of developing export sectors, some of which will be competitive on world markets, even though the economy as a whole has not yet jumped up to full core status. But by the 1990s and the early years of the 21st century, the big stories here were, of course, China and India. China managed to foster a rate of industrial production growth that made it increasingly, almost literally, the workshop of the world. Wages paid were low, workers were exploited. There were many tragic stories in this process which suggested that the Chinese were engaged in a fairly classic early industrial operation that hardly propelled them, as yet at least, to the front ranks of core producers. But the fact was, basic Chinese industrial goods in textiles, in electronics, in gift areas, Christmas in the Western world became increasingly a Chinese celebration in terms of the export industry, the capacity to produce large amounts of produce that was competitive worldwide obviously makes it impossible now to define China as a peripheral or even semi-peripheral economy. India's transformation, emerging a little more slowly but clear by the 21st century, India's transformation involved less emphasis on global manufacturing, although Indian exports competed very successfully in the Indian Ocean basin and beyond, and more the development of service industries, high technology industry, where Indians, among others often skilled in the English language, could play service sector roles and roles in software and related kinds of technological development that propelled India's growth. By the early 21st century, the economies of India and China were growing at a rate of 10% or so a year. And again, while this did not yet catapult them into core status, it clearly promised that if continued, this rate of growth would significantly adjust these economies in terms of broader global relationships. The key point is that for a whole host of societies, many parts, though not all of Latin America, key parts of Eastern and Southern Asia, some sectors in the Middle East, maybe hints by the 21st century of a couple of cases in sub-Saharan Africa, a number of societies, by using one or more innovative methods, a number of societies were able to complicate their definition in the world economy. And this really is the key point. Through the 20th century, though with particular acceleration after World War II, perhaps in the final third of the 20th century and the early 21st, a whole batch of societies began to move into a no man's land between peripheral characteristics and core characteristics. The mixed quality here needs to be emphasized. These societies, for the most part, had not yet caught up to the most advanced levels in terms of life expectancy, education, although educational levels in some cases were accelerating rapidly. So they still could sometimes earn the label Third World, although really it's increasingly misleading and inaccurate.